A cult or sect is often formed from a religious, political, or philosophical outlook, the leaders gathering followers and power as the cult grows. But what if the cult is just about adoration, needing to be loved? Who will follow a leader looking for only that? Children. It started out being just a super cool parent. Most children want one of those. Until being adored was not enough, and absolute obedience was required upon pain of being punished. Even a multi-award-winning, globally known singer's name was dragged into the case. This is the murder of Teresa Fury, and this is Murder Me on Monday.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the Murder Me Monday podcast. I'm Cameron, and joined with me is Mother.
Hello.
So last week, after we recorded an episode for the Patreon, we both went downstairs. You went through into the kitchen, then went through into the living room. I just gone into the kitchen. And then I heard you shouting, no, no, it's not happening. It's not going to happen. And I thought, shit, a family member's died. Like someone really important has died. Something really bad has happened. I come through, you're yelling at the dog because he wants a mini cheddar. He wanted a crisp, and you're shouting, no, it's not happening. No, it can't happen. And it panicked me, and I just wanted to bring that up on the podcast. I am traumatized.
Well, it makes a change from shouting at the TV, because sometimes you come through when I'm doing that, when I'm watching a documentary.
I think you're shouting at me sometimes. Well, I haven't done anything. So what have you got in store for us today then, Mother?
Well, before we get into it, I want to say a big thank you to the New York City Podcast Network and for the voting for us as a star favourite week after week. Really glad you like us, and the promotion really helps. And thank you to everyone for the continued support over on Patreon. By becoming a patron, you not only support our efforts, but also gain access to extra perks such as early access to episodes, bonus content, and even stickers should you want them. Just drop us a line when you sign up giving us your address. If you can't help support us on Patreon, please continue to support us by leaving reviews if you can. It really does help keep us going. Also, this week, we've just updated and installed a link tree, which gives you much easier clickable access to anything that we produce over on our socials. So you can use that link in there if you want to. Before we get into this week's episode, I also want to do a short update from episode 48, Cameron. The murder of Caleb, Bill and Bridget Harrison in Mississauga, Canada. Remember that one? Bumped off the family bit by bit between 2009 and 2013. The ex-wife and the new husband. It seems in January of 2023, the Ontario Court of Appeal overturned the decision and ordered a retrial, said the judge had made two serious errors in his instructions. Melissa walked into court in April 23, all smiles, expecting to be released on bail pending the new trial. She walked out in tears wearing handcuffs and was taken back to jail to await the new trial in January 2024. The reasons for the appeal, well, the judge was having none of it, but we can't tell you what they are because due to a standard publication ban, which is intended to protect the rights of an accused person to a fair trial, no one knows yet why she appealed.
Is the assumption that if the public found out about it and then those were part of the jury that it would affect the outcome?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's going to be added to the watch list. So back to this week's case. This is a slightly older case than normal, but there are reasons for it. One, it's not a well-known case, although there is a documentary on it, which I will link as usual. Two, it's very similar to a very well-known case that's much older that most true crime listeners do know, and we'll chat later about that. But the main reason I decided to do it is one of the witnesses who came up recently. The forensic psychiatrist who testified for the defence in this case, she has also recently testified in a very big case that she got rightly pulled apart for. And we will be covering that in the case autopsy part of the episode, which will be available for Patreon subscribers after the main episode. I'm also not going to use a lot of the names of the people involved that are freely available, as it becomes such a huge playing field of people and difficult to keep straight.
I've got seven names here.
Yes.
And that's after they've been reduced. So yes. I imagine there was a lot more.
Yes. Let me take you to 1031 Madison Avenue, Paterson, New Jersey. The year is 1981. Paterson is one of those places that has some really grim areas and some other areas that are scenic, touristy, and some nice residential areas. It's roughly 170,000 residents. In 1981, Madison Avenue wasn't all that nice. 1031 was an apartment, and there lived Marie Moore. As per usual, not an awful lot known about Marie. She was 35 in 1981, so born around 1946. Post-war baby, and the parents of a different era, who struggled with how the world changed, possibly, which may have affected how the way she turned out. She seems to have gotten pregnant at around 22 years old. The story is that her parents either wanted her to terminate or put the child up for adoption. Again, another story that she may or may not have gotten pregnant due to a sexual assault. But as Marie seems to have had a prolific compulsive liar trait in later years, it's not clear cut if that's the truth. Either way, Marie decides to keep the child, who was a girl, as she wanted someone to love her and be just hers. That statement to me says there was a distinct lack of love in Marie's childhood, and I do know of girls who have had a child for that exact reason, and it never ends well for the child usually. It doesn't in this case, but for different reasons. Marie was older though, and never married, and no mention of boyfriends, or at least any that stuck about. No idea about most of her adult life, education or career, but Marie at one point did work for a local phone company, which is relevant later. July 1981. At the apartment lives Marie, her daughter aged 12, a friend of Marie's called Mary, who was 50, but had also known Marie for many years, and another female child, aged 12, who was apparently another friend of Marie's child, who had been asked to look after the girls, sort of an unofficial fostering type situation. No idea how big the apartment was, but it probably worked if it was two bedrooms and the adults shared and the girls shared. Don't know. Marie's place was the place for some of the local young teenagers to hang out, it seemed. Two boys, a 13-year-old and a 14-year-old called Ricky, and another 12-year-old girl called Teresa. They spent a lot of time there. Ricky, the 14-year-old, and Marie's daughter became close. So close, they were labelled as a couple and dating at 14 and 12. Ricky lived about six blocks away and came from an ordinary household. The 13-year-old boy I have no background on, lived locally and his parents were in the picture. Little Teresa, there's not much. No mention anywhere of her parents, but that she lived with her grandmother nearby. The kids spend the summer all hanging out together. Marie would take them to the beach, bowling, to amusement parks. That stuff isn't usually free, so where the money comes from, who knows? The kids predictably loved it all. The three new additions even took to calling Marie Ma, and she revelled in it. They are all practically living at the apartment during the summer. They rarely went to their own homes. Why would they? They were being treated like adults in their minds and given everything they wanted. September, children are back at school, and although all of them would spend as much time as they could at the apartment before and after school, they still went home most of the time. Things then took a strange turn in that apartment. They had a house phone or landline, as most did back then, and some days it would ring and Marie would answer it, and the children would hear one side of the conversation, something along the lines of, okay, yep, I understand. And then Marie would hang up and turn to the children and tell them that it was her ex-husband, Billy, on the phone. Yes, I did say previously she'd never been married. And apparently Billy had told her that the children had to do specific chores or they would have to be punished for an infraction. Billy had links to the mafia, don't you know? And he knew everything that went on and they had to obey him. These chores often had to be done in a certain way, like cleaning in a certain order, and they often had a time limit, like within the next 30 minutes. The children would do as instructed, and then the phone would ring again, and the same one-sided conversation would be heard, and Marie would tell them that they had taken too long or not done the chore right, according to Billy, and they would have to be punished. But interestingly, Marie's daughter never had to do any of the tasks or chores and was free to leave the apartment and go and play with her other friends. The punisher was to be Ricky, the 14-year-old boyfriend of Marie's daughter. The reason Ricky was to be the one to hand out punishment, well, Billy had decided that Ricky and Marie's daughter were engaged, and if he was to become the head of the household when the two married, he had to act like it. He is 14, she is 12. Sometimes Marie's daughter disobeyed the instruction to go out, and her punishments started. Ricky would take her into her bedroom and put these weird little thumb cuffs on her, like miniature handcuffs but round the thumbs, so she couldn't release her hands. Then he would leave the room and lock her in while he went to punish the other children as instructed. She would sit there, hearing him beating the others and them pleading for him to stop, and there was nothing she could do about it.
So this other 14-year-old Ricky was not just a part of it, he was endorsing it.
Kind of, yeah.
If he is the actual one beating them, because from what you said, it's from her perspective of hearing it. We don't know if it's Ricky, but I'm going to assume it's Ricky.
The punishment wasn't always physical. Ricky would tell the children that there was a bomb planted in the apartment, and if they didn't do as they were told, it would go off and they would all die. The psychological torture of these kids was intense. At a pre-arranged time, Marie made a call to Billy. Marie told Ricky that Billy wanted him to inspect the children's work. Ricky did his inspection and reported to Marie that the others had done an adequate job. Marie replied that Billy said that the cleaning was not done properly because he knew that there was dirt under the kitchen table. Ricky then found the dirt under the table and told Marie that Billy was right. Marie then related Billy's instructions that the children be beaten with a bat. Ricky would beat the children for these failures, and Marie would direct Ricky while talking on the phone with Billy. All of the children and the friend Mary believed that Billy existed and that Marie was speaking with him on the phone. Marie received phone calls instead of just making them to Billy, showing to them that he was actually in touch with her. That could have been anyone on the other end of the phone.
Usually by this point, if it was a fully grown human being, an adult, I would have been like, are they fucking stupid? Why are they doing this? Why do they believe Billy, who's on the phone? She's not on the phone. And there's a bum in the house. What do you mean? They're kids. They're kids, yeah. They're under some weird psychological torture. They're from housing situations that aren't the most traditional.
Yeah.
Some of them are kind of like pseudo-fostered and live with them. So come on, they're going to believe it.
Yeah. But Mary believed she had even met Billy in 1978 when she went with Marie to California. And because of the experience and because she trusted and liked Marie, she believed in Billy's existence and feared him. Why is never explained. By October, the 13-year-old boy had stopped going to Marie's apartment. He had a curfew and his parents enforced it. Plus, Marie was worried that the boy's parents would come around. So Billy told Marie he didn't have to come around anymore. And as a parting gift, Ricky beat the boy one last time, giving him a bloody nose. Ricky's parents had tried to be good parents. Marie had called them and told them that Ricky would be working at the Shore, which I assume is the Jersey Shore from we know of the TV show. He would be working that weekend. Yet Ricky had been told explicitly that he had to be home, but he didn't turn up. His parents discovered that he'd been bunking off school as someone identifying himself as his mother had rung the school and told them that he had a bad back and wouldn't be in. Yep, Marie. Ricky's parents were livid and told him that he was grounded and would be taken to and from school for the next 5 days, and that's exactly what they did.
I'd be more worried about some woman ringing up and claiming to be me.
Yeah.
And the school just allowing it. That's a safeguarding referral or something there. Someone needs to get in trouble.
Yeah, but it's the 1980s and...
Oh, yeah, that school's full of asbestos. Yeah, they don't care.
Yeah.
A couple of kids go missing, oh well.
So Ricky's mum's taking him to and from school and she noticed that they were actually being followed by a strange car. Yeah, it was Marie. But he ran away after that week and went straight back to Marie's. Ricky's parents tried, but... nothing was happening. Ricky also stopped sleeping on the sofa as he had done previously and started sharing Marie's bed, as according to her, she had needs that only he could fulfill. One of those needs was being punished. Marie would have Ricky assault her for failing to keep the other children in line or for supposedly lying to Billy on one occasion, and she would tell him that Billy had ordered the punishment. Ricky would hit Marie approximately twice a day with either a bat, his hands, or a book. Yep, child abuse 101, isn't it? Ricky's parents didn't give up, and Ricky would call them regularly. But Marie was so inside his head, he felt compelled to stay. Ricky's parents even filed a police report. And then, when authorities turned up, would hide Ricky in a crawl space. And Marie, she just didn't know anything. She had no idea where he was. And he was 2 foot away from the officers. Ricky also then started to beat Marie's daughter, who had so far been untouchable. And Marie did nothing to stop it. Because Billy agreed to the beatings, because Billy was Marie's daughter's dad. So who was Billy? An album was released in 1980, and one of the massive chart-topping hits was It's Still Rock and Roll to Me. A relatively local lad from New York, yes, Billy Joel was Marie's ex-husband. Except he wasn't. And had never been married to Marie, didn't know her, had never met her, and certainly wasn't linked to the mafia that anyone knew of, and most certainly wasn't Marie's daughter's dad. This was a couple of years before Uptown Girl in 1983, but he was still a huge star. And at this point, I was, how does anybody not know this case? I remember, I think, a 2-inch paragraph in a newspaper, and that was it. It gets worse. Ricky is now living with the family and Billy suddenly doesn't need to use the phone anymore to contact them. Marie is out and comes home telling everyone that Billy's men pulled her over in her car and gave her an injection that would allow Billy to come into her body and speak through her.
Okay, I know you get doomsday cults and the kids inevitably believe it because that's what they've been born and raised into. But are they genuinely believing this? Are they not having any kind of flags appear in their head? Little dings? Hang on. An injection in her head that lets Billy speak to her telepathically.
I'll explain why.
Why have I never heard this?
I'll explain why. So Marie asked them to keep giving her coffee because of the drug that had been injected. It supposedly made it work around her body faster. And they were sitting in the kitchen. And Marie put her hands on her face, removed them and said, I'm not Marie, I'm Billy. This is horror movie possession type stuff for these kids. The children and Mary believed that Billy was in Marie's body because she sounded different. Her voice was really cold and she began talking like a man and her voice got deeper.
She's some sort of weird theatre kid. She enjoyed the acting part.
Yeah. In addition, she sounded more demanding and had a meaner voice and she swore a lot, which was something that Marie had not done before. Marie began to change into Billy regularly and would give Ricky orders in the masculine voice.
I guess actually it's not going to be too dissimilar from a young child witnessing their parent get drunk, because they could go from being a really polite, nice person, they get pissed up and they start swinging. Could be the same thing with how they're seeing...
Or drugs. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's like you become corrupted and fell version of yourself, like an evil version of yourself. So for them, it's probably not that difficult to make that leap. They've probably seen people get drunk and go a bit crazy. So why is this not possible in their eyes?
I also wondered if it was like almost a Stockholm syndrome as well by this point type scenario. Ricky is also beating the housemate Mary under instructions from Billy. That unofficial foster daughter tried twice to escape, but on the 27th of November 1981, finally managed to get away. She actually had a brother living nearby in a place called Lodi. That name's familiar, but I don't know why. But as she didn't know the way to get to him, she would stop and ask for directions. One of the people she stopped noticed she had no coat or shoes in November, so called the police. When they found her, she bolted like the frightened child she was, but they eventually managed to catch her and take her to a hospital where she was found to have beaten so badly she had to stay in for a week. She initially refused to give the police any names, but just said that someone named Sir or Boss was beating her at the direction of someone on the phone. But in the hospital, she told the children's caseworker names and addresses. So when these caseworkers turn up at Marie's and ask her, Marie was that good, she convinced them that this child was fantasizing. That left the caseworkers with a problem. No doubt that the child had been assaulted, but no evidence it was who she had named. So that poor child was sent to some sort of facility for 90 days. Marie even told Ricky that it was Billy who had actually run that child over, and that was the price to pay for defying Billy, which scared Ricky even more. Marie and her now small cult of her daughter, her friend Mary, Teresa and Ricky upped and moved to what was called the second floor of another house in Paterson. The owner of the house was a friend of Marie's, but she told everyone that the man was actually her child's grandfather. So would that be Billy's dad or her dad? The punishments continued. Teresa and Mary bore the brunt of them, including those thumb cuffs. Ricky would thumb cuff Mary and Teresa in the nude and force them to remain like that for close to an hour at a time. Ricky would supplement the thumb cuffing with various other punishments, including kicking, blows with a bat or book, and cigarette burns. Mary managed to break free on the 31st of May 1982. Mary went to work that day, not to make money for the household that Marie wanted, but only to use the phone to contact her brothers and sisters, who took her to the local police department. The detective spoke with Mary for almost 3 hours, and she eventually allowed him to look at her body to see the extent of the beatings. The detective convinced Mary to go to the hospital for medical attention as, in his words, she was in a really bad way. Mary later gave a statement to the police describing the beatings and tortures she had endured at Ricky's hands. She did not name Billy, but did name Marie as someone who knew what was being done and gave the address, as well as alerting the authorities to the punishment that Teresa was suffering. That sparked an investigation, and in June, the police and child services tried to talk to Teresa, who was still going to school, and to Marie's daughter. Both denied anything was going on. The authorities then tied up what was happening to that other unofficial foster daughter and basically went mob-handed to Marie's place and actually had to stop Teresa from bolting. She is examined. Authorities see Teresa is black and blue. Teresa and Marie are, oh, she must have fallen at school. Teresa is taken for a formal medical examination, and the doctor states categorically that she has been abused and none of the injuries are accidental. Police managed to get a statement about the abuse from the unofficial foster daughter, but Teresa would only give one that implicated Ricky, She refused to say Marie had anything to do with what had happened to her. Mary had also given a statement. We have statements coming out of our ears at this point, and even Marie gives one saying she was the victim of abuse and it's all Ricky. Ricky, however, is in the wind. As far as police are concerned, they can't find him, except he's actually hiding out at Marie's behind various false walls and things. Marie had also managed to get to that 13-year-old boy who'd escaped this whatever the hell it is months earlier and had told him that Billy would kill him if he told the authorities anything. The caseworkers then screw up royally, but also probably accidentally, as maybe they couldn't tell the woman all the allegations. Because Teresa's grandmother contacted Marie and told her that the caseworkers and the police wanted to talk to Teresa again, and that made Billy tell Teresa she was now living permanently with Marie, her daughter, and Ricky. We are now in October 1982. No one has been arrested or charged, and Teresa is still with Marie, even though doctors have told police and child services she's been abused. They are all still living at that house on the third floor with the pervert landlord, which is actually not anybody's grandparent. That house had a fourth floor. This ragtag of whatever they were all moved up to the fourth floor. During the day, Ricky helped keep Teresa cuffed to a hook on the kitchen wall. At night, Ricky would transfer her to the bathroom where he would cuff her to the bathtub. And he also sexually abused her. That landlord, the supposed grandfather, I say he's now revealed to be a pervert, as Marie would take Teresa down four flights of stairs so he could abuse her, and he would pay Marie as her pimp. They all had stopped Teresa from wearing clothes, and they would only allow her to wear disposable nappies. She was not allowed to use the bathroom. The torture continued, being tied up in a bath and being removed in a morning so Marie's daughter could use it before going to school. She was not being fed and appeared to be having seizures and would frequently strike her head off the sides of the bathtub. It was completely involuntary movement, not deliberate, as many accounts would have you believe. On her final day, Teresa was unresponsive in that bath. They tried dragging her upright while still thumb-cuffed, but she slumped back down. But Marie and co. did not actually check for signs of life. The daughter goes off to school and Marie tells Ricky to put Teresa's body in a bathroom crawl space. She would have been alive at this point. What they actually did was tape her up and hide her in the attic and tell Marie's daughter that they had sent the body to Billy's place in New York City. May or June 1983. Marie and Ricky removed Teresa's body from the attic to the wall space in a bedroom because they were moving from that apartment. Marie and Ricky covered up the hole leading to the crawl space with wood, which they nailed into a wall before concealing the hole with wallpaper. Marie was still chatting to Teresa's grandmother, asking her if she knew where Teresa was. And she was also still hiding Ricky from the police and just carrying on. The police would periodically pop up, try and find Ricky. Nope, don't know where he is. He's not here. Have a look. Off you go. So it's just Marie, her daughter, and Ricky now. They moved to a place called Martin Street, which was still within the town. Marie also gets Ricky a job. She tells the personnel manager only she was allowed to pick Ricky up as she was his mother. And he works for about 6 weeks as a maintenance worker. How it all unravels is rather epic. Ricky is at work. Turned out he had a brother who also worked there. The long and the short, the brother told his mother, I think I've seen Ricky. Mother turns up at work and Ricky does a runner. Mum does the only thing she could. She calls the police and Ricky is arrested at the new place he shared with Marie. They actually found him hiding under a sink. They also bring Marie in for questioning, and true to form, she lied, but she got caught. It's a mess. There are charges about missing Teresa, child endangerment, sexual assault charges. Marie can't behave herself. She constantly tried to contact Ricky, even tried to take a contract out on his life. They're both out on bail, by the way.
Well, she tried to kill Ricky now.
Yeah, she tried to take contract out on him. So they're both out on bail. Ricky's bailed to his parents and she's out. September 1983.
Would there be different bail conditions because Ricky's a child at this point? Yes. He's at 14, 15.
Yeah. Yeah, there would have been.
Even though the crimes are basically suspected to be the same, the age is still a factor.
They just know so far that Teresa's missing.
There's a crime afoot, but they don't know the severity or the conditions of that crime. Okay, I'm just wondering. I assumed it would be the case because he's a child, so he's still under the care of his parents. Yes. So, just a question.
Yeah. So Marie has moved away from that pervert landlord that she pimped poor Teresa out to, yet she still has custody of her daughter. She hasn't been found guilty of anything yet, but you would think there would have been some reasonable cause to remove the girl, but no.
Oh, no, it's innocent until proven guilty, even with a suspicion.
Mm. Her daughter had a friend who had an older sibling and a partner. Marie met them. She charmed them all so much, they called her Ma, just like her first victims. This time, however, Marie tells them all about her troubles with Ricky and how he is responsible for everything bad that's happened to her. And they believe every word. Guess who also pops up again? Yep, good old Billy Joel is on the phone.
I'd be dubious about this. Can they genuinely believe a 14-year-old or 15-year-old as he is now, were you capable of being the mastermind behind this whole thing?
She's good.
Not even in his own house. It's in someone else's house where she seemingly has like six other people and a 50-year-old roommate or whatever. That he's somehow masterminded this whole process. I'd be, even if it was the truth, I don't think I'm going to believe you because I don't think that's possible.
We're a bit more sceptical, I think. Plus, this young couple, they were young as well. They were in their early 20s again, so probably a little bit naive, maybe.
In my early 20s, would I have believed this?
No. No. Well, they did believe it until the same old injection story and then the side eyes came in. But these people did try and intimidate Ricky for Marie, but nothing was working. So Marie ups the ante. She comes up with a scenario and makes the players practice them. And then on the 17th of December, she contacted the police.
I told her she was a theatre kid.
Yeah, yeah.
She's loving this acting part. Jesus Christ.
She tells the police that her daughter had just told her that Ricky had sexually abused her. Marie also told the police that based on what her daughter had told her, she believed that Ricky had murdered Teresa, whose body might be hidden in that apartment that they'd left. There ended up a cat and mouse game until police found the body at the old apartment. And it was Marie's manipulating the pervert landlord and then trying to manipulate the police. But they actually knew what she was up to. On the 22nd of December 1983, the medical examiner performed an autopsy on Teresa Fury. Her autopsy revealed that a blow to her head and face had killed her, but that she had been alive for a number of hours after it, albeit in a coma. The blow to the head was consistent with falling on a bathtub or a hard floor, while the injury to the face could have been caused by falling against a bathtub or by a direct blow, such as a hard kick. The blood that had gathered around the blow to the face and head indicated that Teresa had been alive before they wrapped her up and taped her body and then put her up in the attic. The extent of the hemorrhaging suggested that she lived as long as 4 to 8 hours after the injuries. There was not enough soft tissue remaining to determine whether Teresa had suffocated as a result of the taping and wrapping of her body, although it was possible. 28th of December 1983, Marie gives a statement to the police and admitted that Billy was not real, but no, he was all in her head. And Ricky, being around, would bring him out. She told them that she would not remember what happened when she was Billy and that she wanted to get rid herself of that personality. And yeah, it's all Ricky's fault. She mentioned, however, that she did not want to go to the crazy house. She's promptly arrested.
And sent to the crazy house.
After reviewing statements from all the victims and other witnesses, the prosecutor decided not to charge Ricky as an adult and entered a plea agreement instead, whereby he would charge Ricky as a juvenile with a maximum custodial term of 3 years. But he had to testify against Marie. On the 16th of April 1984, the grand jury returned a 33-count indictment against Marie Moore. The trial was predictable. He said, she said, until it came to the defence case. They put on the stand three experts who all agreed, shocker, but the primary defence was DID or dissociative identity disorder.
Would that have been a common excuse back then?
No, it really wasn't. They also said that Marie had brain damage, namely frontal lobe atrophy.
Oh, I could get behind that.
And possibly seizures, maybe epilepsy, but no evidence except Marie's word. The prosecution called three expert rebuttal witnesses. These witnesses concluded that Marie did not suffer from a multiple personality disorder, that she was in fact malingering, and that she was therefore not legally insane. They did, however, conclude that Marie suffered from a personality disorder of some type. One of them actually said antisocial personality disorder. I'd say she's got a bloody handful of disorders. Oh, and the reason for the dissociative identity disorder, according to the defence, sexual abuse perpetrated by her own father. Seen that one too many times. Marie's father basically had to testify in his own defence, even though he was not on trial. Marie was found guilty and, at the penalty phase, after 7 hours of deliberation, the jury returned a sentence of death on the 19th of November 1984. Of course, it doesn't stop there. Appeals. The death penalty was overturned as a couple of counts against her were dismissed, but she didn't get off. 3rd of January 1985, she was sentenced to 224 and a half years with a minimum period before applying for parole of 87 and a half years. Another appeal in 1988, and it's reduced to 135 years with parole at 62 years.
Is the hope that they can whittle it down after about 50 appeals that it's now actually only 25 years and by that point you're 105 and you just die anyway? I don't get it. It went from half a millennium to just like a tenth of one. Bro, you're still gonna like 150 years past your sell-by date.
Yeah, it makes no sense to me. It really doesn't.
You said she was sentenced to death. That must mean she's one of the rare few women that was sentenced to death.
Yeah, she was. She very much so, but it was overturned.
Especially back then as well, even in the 80s, it was pretty... It would have been uncommon for a woman to be sentenced to death.
Fairly unusual. Very interesting that the documentary is the only place that mentions what happened to Marie after sentencing. Her daughter visited her for almost 20 years. And then Marie seemingly found a lump. She died from breast cancer. That would have been around 2005 maybe. So she would have been around 60 years old. She certainly disappeared from all the lists that hold prisoners' names. And I did read that her mum had passed from the same illness. There was a mention of a sister having breast cancer as well, but I've not found anything about a sister. And that is the end of the main episode. And finally, the victim, who should not be forgotten, Teresa Fury, aged 13.
So everyone, that's the end of the podcast. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram, Murder Me Monday Podcast. Email us at murdermemondaypodcast@gmail.com. If you liked it, please like, favourite, subscribe, all that usual shit. You can find our Patreon in the description below. And if you are on the Patreon, hang about because we'll be doing the case autopsy. Peace.